The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, just a quick note that the podcast is on hiatus this week, but we're bringing back a fan favorite. Here's my interview with the amazing Tana French from late 2020 at the height of the pandemic. Catch you soon, and thanks so much for your support.
And I didn't know if I could write a book because I'd written, you know, short stories and really galactically awful teenage poetry, but I'd never tried to write a book before. But I reckoned I could probably write maybe a scene and then another scene and then, oh man, I've got a chapter there.
Greetings, scribes, and welcome back to The Writer Files. I am still your humble host, Kelton Reed, sending you positivity, prolificness, per usual during these strange days. This week, New York Times bestselling crime novelist Tana French took a break to talk with me about her early training as an actress, her definition of creativity, and how to write through the tough times. The author's written 8 mystery novels and is considered a master of suspense and the modern psychological thriller. Her work's been compared to writers including James Ellroy and Donna Tartt, and she's been called incandescent by Stephen King and absolutely mesmerizing by Gillian Flynn. Her novels have sold over 3 million copies and won numerous awards, including the Edgar and Barry Awards, the LA Times Book Prize for Best Mystery Thriller, and the Irish Book Award for Crime. Her latest bestseller, The Searcher, is her second standalone novel, and she was described by The Washington Post as the most important crime novelist to emerge in the past 10 years. Stay tuned for a clip from The Searcher audiobook at the break, excerpted courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio and read by Roger Clark. In this file, Tana and I discussed her galactically bad poetry. The archaeological dig that inspired In the Woods, her Edgar-winning 2007 debut, how she came to riff on the Western genre in her latest novel, and why writers need to fight off the struggle of isolation. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates, get links to merch, and other resources for writers. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us. All right, we are back on The Writer Files. I am thrilled today to be joined by a very special guest. I've got Tana French joining us. And man, you must be busy right now. You're kind of on a virtual tour, is that right?
Yeah, virtual tour, Zoom tour, where we all live our lives these days, Zoom.
Yeah, we're Zooming. And it's a pleasure to have you on, and thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Of course. So how are you surviving these very bizarro times we're experiencing?
Oof. Well, I think writers probably had it easier than most because I already worked from home. It wasn't like a huge big transition, you know what I mean? The main thing has been 2 kids during lockdown running around the whole time. That took a little bit of getting used to, but still, you know, it's got its good sides, definitely. Staying safe, keeping fingers crossed.
For sure, like so many right now. It's interesting because, you know, we speak with so many writers just about kind of how they're dealing with the pandemic and their sanity and all that stuff. But you know, I do hear complaints about wanting to get out to a coffee shop and or get out to an indie bookshop and meet your adoring fans. But yeah, let's talk about writing and the writing life and this fantastic career that you've had. But I understand, you know, it kind of was a circuitous journey like so many authors. Take us back a little bit. Yep. And just as we do, dig into your kind of origin story as a, you know, how you became this best-selling thriller writer and those early years of, you know, but, take us back to maybe when you were an actor or...
I'm the only person who went into writing for the job security, right?
Because, sure.
Yeah. At least now, you know, if you have a 2-book contract, that's 4 years of job security right there, which as an actor, that's unheard of. That's like the dream, you know, you're lucky to have 4 months if you're an actor. No, I was in between two shows and I got a few weeks work on an archaeological dig, which, you know, I've always been fascinated by archaeology and it's a more interesting way of paying the rent than a lot of them. And I was working on this dig that wasn't too far from a wood. And I thought, man, that would be a great place for kids to play. Hmm. And then I thought, okay, what if 3 kids ran in there and only one came out and he had no memory of what had happened to the other two? Like normal people would have stopped at great place for kids to play, but a mystery writer, you're always looking for the potential mystery and everything. Mm-hmm. What would that do to his head as he grew up? And what if he became a detective and a murder case brought him back to that wood? So I scribbled the idea down on like the back of a phone bill and went off to do the next show and forgot the whole thing. But then I was moving flat and I found the phone bill and I went, oh, that idea. I really want to know what would happen. And it dawned on me that nobody was going to write it for me. If I wanted to know how that idea would pan out, I was going to have to actually do something about it myself. And I didn't know if I could write a book because I'd written, you know, short stories and really galactically awful teenage poetry, but I'd never tried to write a book before. But I reckoned I could probably write maybe a scene and then another scene and then, oh man, I've got a chapter there. And when I realized that I was really serious about this is when I turned down a show because I wanted to focus on the book. And if you know any actors, they don't turn down work. They just don't. So that was the moment when I went, okay, I'm really taking this seriously. I really am going to give it everything and try and make it work. And I got very, very lucky.
Well, since then, since your debut novel, In the Woods, this recent release is your 8th novel now, is that right?
Yeah. I'm still going, wow, 8? How did that happen?
That's pretty amazing. And quite a success since then. So tell us a little bit about kind of, I want to dig into your process a little bit, but tell us a little bit about the departure for this latest one, because I understand, you know, it is a standalone, much like The Witch Elm. And it's a little bit different for you, but similar in ways. Tell us a little bit about the process that went into, you know, what inspired The Searcher.
Yeah, it is. It is a bit different. And I wanted to try something different. I don't want to get caught in the trap, which is easy to fall into, of writing the same book over and over. And when I was bouncing around ideas for this one, I'd been reading a lot of Westerns. And I've been thinking, you know, those Western settings, they've got a lot of resonances with the West of Ireland. Like, it's harsh country, it demands toughness from anyone who wants to live there. And that Western sense of a place that's very distant from the centers of power, so that the people living there feel like the power brokers don't know or care about their lives. They've got to make and enforce their own rules. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, what about transposing some Western tropes to the West of Ireland, see if they work there? And that kind of necessitated a very different kind of writing. Because if you're taking a riff on a Western, these tend to be people who are focused much more on actions than on thoughts, feelings, whatever. And I've written a lot of books where they were first person and where the action, the core of the action was the main character's head, inside the main character's head. Yeah. Whereas this one, Cal, the narrator, he doesn't really think it matters that much what you think or feel. Those aren't the things that define you. What defines you is what you do, what action you take in the face of difficult situations. So that kind of defined the book as being necessarily third person, because for him, the important things aren't his thoughts and feelings. Those are not quite irrelevant, but not top priority. So you need to take that step outside and you need to make it third person. But also, one of the Western tropes I liked was the stranger in town. You know how he strolls into the saloon and he's got a secret or two, and he's going to disrupt stuff. He's going to be a catalyst. Maybe he'll like shoot the corrupt sheriff and set the town to rights, or maybe he's going to get shot because the town closes ranks against him, or he's going to shoot the hero, cause devastation. Whatever way, though, he's going to be someone who disrupts the accepted patterns and brings some hidden things to light. So he seemed like I wanted to play with that idea. But that also meant that my main character couldn't be Irish, because Ireland is small, man, right? Even if he came from the opposite end of the country, there would be a connection to this tiny village. Like, he would have been in training with someone who came from there, or his mum would have worked with someone from there, something. And within an hour, the local sort of shopkeeper and information repository, she would have ferreted out that connection and used it to place him within the framework of the town. And I didn't want that. I wanted the proper outsider. And that meant he needed to be from another country. So for the first time, I'm writing an American narrator instead. So yeah, it was a very different way of working on a book, very different kind of book.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Yeah, it's interesting to say that, because I know I had read that you had read some Larry McMurtry kind of early on that inspired you. And I think Lonesome Dove was like my dad's favorite book of his. We had the DVDs growing up. He made me watch those a lot. And those characters are amazing. And they're kind of, as you put it, like morally ambiguous in a sense. But, you know, I think when I think of kind of the cinematic quality of rewriting, it makes sense that you came from an acting background and a drama background. And then I think of, you know, great films like Akira Kurosawa movies, like Yojimbo. I don't know if you remember that one.
I haven't seen it. That's on the list, but yeah.
I think, you know, Bruce Willis did an American remake of it that was a Western version of it. Yeah. But they all kind of lean on the same tropes, as you put it, but interesting nonetheless. But very cool. And congrats on the successes and the early praise. I mean, you've got some really big fans, and of course these blurbs are a lot of fun. So what's next for you? What are you working on? I know that you've in some interviews you've mentioned that you've had some struggles with writing and your processes. So maybe talk a little bit about what you're doing.
I don't think it's so much struggles as just it's natural. Everybody's head is melted these days. You know, we're all using up all our bandwidth trying to just work out what the hell is going on and what we're supposed to be doing about it. Yeah. And I think it's just natural enough. It's kind of hard to get enough clear space in your head to come up with a new idea. I mean, I got lucky. I handed in this book like 2 weeks before Ireland went poof. Right. So I was doing edits and copy edits and proofreads during lockdown rather than trying to come up with something from scratch. Mm. And I think it's harder to come up with something from scratch when your subconscious is basically just smoking wasteland here. So I've got an idea. I'm bouncing it around. But I reckon it's likely to take a little longer and a little more clear space before I can turn it into a book. Mm-hmm. But you just kind of have to work around it, like everybody else, find ways to work around it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I've asked a lot of authors the same question, like how do you think it's going to affect your process? Or, you know, how can it not, this very strange time? You know, and I hear people saying, you know, oh, well, we'll look back on this time with some nostalgia when it's all over. But, you know, we're in the new normal. And I think, you know, how can it not kind of bleed into our subconscious or our work, right?
Well, I think that's going to be really interesting, because I think this is going to take years for people to process enough to write about it in any coherent way. I mean, I'm sure there'll be instant pandemic books, people responding instantly with some kinds of books, but I don't think it's possible for those to have the detachment and the space to have processed any of what's going on. That's going to take, I don't know, 5 years, maybe more. So I think it is going to bleed through, though, in ways, because, like you said, there will be things that we'll look back on positively. There have been things that have been positives out of all this, you know, more space to spend time with families, more space to do stuff like, you know, long bike rides around the neighborhood, baking things, making art. There's been space for that.
Yeah.
But that's all been within this very strange dystopian framework. Mm-hmm. So the ways of filtering out, okay, what were the good sides of this? How did they fit within this framework? And how do I make sense of all of this on a psychological level? I think that's going to take quite a while for anybody to process enough to put it into a book.
Yeah.
I think, you know what? People keep saying, are you going to write about this? I'm like, well, I don't even want to live through it. I'm going to wind up writing like fluffy Regency romance if this goes on much longer.
Well, one of your fans, Stephen King, has called your work terrifying, amazing, incandescent. But it does kind of feel like we're all living in a Stephen King novel. And I've heard this positive.
This is all his fault.
It is, I think.
Well, reality, because nobody does that better than him, where reality seems to be one thing and then it's just pulled askew. Everything is just that bit distorted and you can't get back. And it might look like a normal day when you look out your window, but then you start seeing the indications that it's not and you can't find your way back. So yeah, Stephen King is actually a pretty good comparison.
Well, it's cool to see the New York Times, of course, gushing about your latest. And they have a whole essential Dana French that I will wow. link to, which wow. is great. If you want to go back, you can read a little bit about all of her previous work there. I'll link to that, your homepage
Thank
there.
Thank you.
TanaFrench.com, and you're on Facebook. All those links will go in. Of course, I will link to the latest. Tell us a little bit about, I don't know. I mean, I think the big one right now for writers is just how to keep going, how to persevere through tough times, through lean times, mm-hmm. whatever it may be, because, you know, probably a lot of writers who don't have access right now, who aren't getting in front of audiences, who, you know, are dealing with kind of pandemic fatigue and, I don't know, the issues with isolation that we're all feeling. Whether you're with your family or not, it's kind of unavoidable, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
What do you want to say? What advice do you want to offer to your fellow scribes on just how to keep their chin up, you know?
Oh man, I think there's two different elements. One is on the writing level and one is just on the isolation level. On the writing level, somebody asked me one time, you know, how do you not get pulled down? Because she said, you know, most of the writers I know get pulled down by the idea that, oh my God, what if it's not good enough? What if this is crap? And I said, well, I mean, I'm going to write it anyway. So why would I waste energy worrying about whether it's crap? It might be. It's entirely possible that it is, but I'm still going to finish it and I'm still going to work on it. I'm still going to fix it. So it feels like a waste of energy to focus on whether or not it's crap when that won't make any difference to my actions. So I guess that's the only useful thing I can offer on the writing through tough times front is, listen, you know you're going to do it. You know you're going to write that book anyway, because otherwise you wouldn't be here doing it. So cut yourself some slack and don't use the time worrying about whether it's crap. Just, you know, you're going to do it, do it. On the struggle and the isolation thing, I think one thing I've noticed during the pandemic is that people are really good at coming up with creative ways around things. costs. I know a lot of actors and people in theater companies, and now that's one that you literally cannot make work in the normal way during any form of lockdown or restrictions. You can't have people in a theater. I mean, you can have a lot of people on an airplane, but apparently airplanes are magic and you can't have anybody in a theater at all. So actors and production companies are finding ways to make it work. They're doing readings on Zoom. They're doing socially distanced things that are screened as drive-ins. They're finding creative ways to make it work. And I think writers probably are doing very much the same thing. They're finding online writing groups, online reading groups, Zoom things that can act as a way to reconnect to each other in what is already can be a very solitary profession. And now you add this extra layer of solitude on top of it. It is extra tough. So I think some writers anyway have been finding different ways to work around this, really amazingly creative ways to work around this. For me, you know, I'm in lockdown with my husband and two kids who I love, but there's a lot of not solitude. Solitude has not been a challenge that I have had to overcome over the last while.
Yeah, you know, I think that's going to resonate with a lot of writers right now. Yeah, so tell us a little bit about what's next. And, you know, and I wanted to ask about Dublin Murders and kind of like your involvement with some of the adaptations of your work. Is there anything in the pipeline with any other adaptation stuff or hopes for the future?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the same company bought the rights to all six Dublin Murder Squad books at once. So
yeah,
they could do the next two. But, you know, I mean, we're in the middle of all this. Who knows? I wasn't right. really involved. I was initially going to be because I was under the impression that it was going to be an adaptation of the books. Yeah. But it gradually became clear that actually what they wanted to do was a complete reimagination. And I went, okay, I'm not going to be useful here. The only thing, nobody wants the author there going, excuse me, that's not like that in the book. that's not anything useful. So I went, okay, I'm going to back right off and let you guys, who are very high up professionals, let you do your thing. So I don't actually know whether it had very much in common with the books, the first series, but there were a load of amazing actors working on it. You can't go too far wrong. So I think it's probably better if they're going to do the next series. Again, if they're focusing on a reimagination, I don't think that I'm going to be particularly useful. I think I would be a pain in the backside rather than anything productive. So I'm going to do the same thing and go, you guys do what you do. I'll be over here doing what I can actually do usefully, which is writing the next book.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's wrap up with a fun one. If you could take any author from any era to dinner, all expenses paid, to your favorite spot in the world, who would you take? Where would you take them? Go.
Oh, where? I don't know, but I'm going to be so the most boring answer in the universe. I'm going to go for Shakespeare because I want to know how this guy worked so fast. Yeah. It takes me 2 years to write one book, and he was just popping out these genius level plays every few weeks. Oh, yeah, you need another one for next Tuesday? Sure, here's something that is full of lines so beautiful that in hundreds of years, they're still going to be blowing people's minds. Mm-hmm. I want to know if he thought that way in normal conversation, if he was just firing at a level that and a speed that the rest of us can't even picture, or what? How did this guy's mind do that and do it so fast? That's what I'd love to do.
Absolutely. Interesting question there, I think.
Yeah.
As to whether or not he was one person, because yeah, the prolificness and oh man, and how it stands the test of time is pretty amazing. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this, Tanner French.
Thank you so much.
The Searcher is the latest. Of course, we will link to all the places. And Tanner French skillfully builds suspense as The Search reveals great turmoil beneath the village's bucolic facade. I hope I'm pronouncing all these words correctly. A country noir that finds tenderness in the troubled hearts of its recalcitrant characters. That's a book list review. Congrats on all the successes, and we wish you the best of luck on your virtual tour. Is there anywhere else you want to point your fans?
There's a Facebook page for Town of French. That's the main place for all the news and updates and everything else out there.
Yeah, yeah.
And thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, stay safe out there and stay prolific, and we appreciate you.
Thank you. You stay safe too. Take care.
That was great.
That was fun.
When Cal comes out of the house, the rooks have got hold of something. Six of them are clustered on the back lawn, amid the long wet grass and the yellow-flowered weeds, jabbing and hopping. Whatever the thing is, it's on the small side and still moving. Cal sets down his garbage bag of wallpaper. He considers getting his hunting knife and putting the creature out of its suffering. But the rooks have been here a lot longer than he has. It would be pretty impertinent of him to waltz in and start interfering with their ways. Instead, he eases himself down to sit on the mossy step next to the trash bag. He likes the rooks. He read somewhere that they're smart as hell. They can get to know you, bring you presents even. For 3 months now, he's been trying to butter them up with scraps left on the big stump towards the bottom of the garden. They watch him trudge up and down through the grass, from the ivy-loaded oak where they have their colony, and as soon as he's a safe distance away, they swoop down to squabble and comment raucously over the scraps. But they keep a cynical eye on Cal, and if he tries to move closer, they're gone, back into the oak, to jeer down at him and drop twigs on his head. Yesterday afternoon, he was in his living room, stripping away the mildewed wallpaper, and a sleek, mid-sized rook landed on the sill of the open window, yelled what was obviously an insult, and then flapped off, laughing. The thing on the lawn twists wildly, shaking the long grass. A big daddy rook jumps closer, aims one neat, ferocious stab of his beak, and the thing goes still. Rabbit, maybe. Cal has seen them out there in the early mornings, nibbling and dashing in the dew. Their holes are somewhere in his back field, down by the broad copse of hazels and rowans. Once his firearm license comes through, he's planning to see if he remembers what his grandpa taught him about skinning game, and if the mule-tempered broadband will deign to find him a recipe for rabbit stew. The rooks crowd in, pecking hard and bracing their feet to jerk out bites of flesh, more of them zooming down from the tree to jostle in on the action. Cal watches them for a while, stretching out his legs and rolling one shoulder in circles. Working on the house is using muscles he'd forgotten he had. He finds new aches every morning, although some of that is likely from sleeping on a cheap mattress on the floor. Cal is too old and too big for that, but there's no point in bringing good furniture into the dust and damp and mold. He'll buy that stuff once he has the house in shape, and once he figures out where you buy it. All that was Donna's department. Meanwhile, he doesn't mind the aches. They satisfy him. Along with the blisters and thickening calluses, they're solid, earned proof of what his life is now. It's headed into the long, cool September stretch of evening, but cloudy enough that there's no trace of a sunset. The sky, dappled in subtle gradations of gray, goes on forever. So do the fields, coated in shades of green by their different uses, divided up by sprawling hedges, dry stone walls, and the odd narrow back road. Away to the north, a line of low mountains rolls along the horizon. Cal's eyes are still getting used to looking this far, after all those years of city blocks. Landscape is one of the few things he knows of where the reality doesn't let you down. The west of Ireland looked beautiful on the internet. From right smack in the middle of it, it looks even better. The air is rich as fruitcake. Like you should do more with it than just breathe it. Bite off a big mouthful, maybe, or rub handfuls of it over your face. After a while, the rooks slow down, getting towards the end of their meal. Cal stands up and picks up the trash bag again. The rooks cock smart, instant glances at him, and when he starts down the garden, heave themselves into the air and flap their full bellies back to their tree. He hauls the bag down to a corner beside the creeper-covered, tumble-down stone shed, pausing along the way to check out the rook's dinner. Rabbit, all right. A young one, although barely recognizable now.
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.